Chapter 23. Invading the Invasion. Bent Angles. In the Gardens of the Saruthi. The war had already begun. 56 Izar hung like a pearl in space, milky white and gleaming. Vivid flashes and slower blossoms of destruction underlit its translucent skin of cloud. The heretic fleet had arrived 2 days ahead of us and had begun its assault of the planet. I kept thinking of it as Estrom's fleet, but it wasn't, of course. I had made certain of that. This was Locke's battle fleet now, I was sure. The 13 ships had blockaded 56 Izar in a non-standard but effective conquest pattern. Serial waves of their fighter bombers, interceptors, and dropships rained down on the planet, and the orbiting heavies bombarded the surface with their entire batteries. They detected our battle pack the moment we came out of warp. Their picket ships, the heavy destroyers Nebuchadnezzar and Fournier, wheeled round to protect their hindquarters. Admiral Spatian held our battle pack off orbit and chased the frigate's defense of Stalinvast, Emperor's Hammer, and Will of Iron straight in to clear the way. On their heels, he sent out the massed fighter squadrons of the expeditionary force and diverted the battleship Valpecula to engage the enemy flagship, a heavy cruiser named the Lionkur. The Emperor's Hammer and the Will of Iron pincered and torched the Nebuchadnezzar after a brief but fierce exchange. The explosion lit the void. The defense of Stalinvast and the Fournier locked each other tightly in a longer, slower dance of warships, and eventually slammed together, squeezing boarding parties and naval security units into each other's hulls. The locked ships tumbled away in an embrace of death. The Valpecula raced forward and misjudged the Lionkur's evasion, suffering a trio of broadsides. Coming about, spilling debris into the gulf, the Imperial battleship raised its guns and hammered the Lionkur so hard and so furiously that the enemy flagship broke up and blew out like a dying sun. Limping, the Valpecula turned slowly and began its long-range harrying of the enemy ships closer to the target world's atmosphere. Spatian committed the rest of his group then, ranging them forward in a three-pronged division, of which the central and largest was headed by the majestic Saint Sithus. Distances closed. The near space of 56 Izar was awash with fire patterns and the streaking comets of missiles. Now the ferocious high-velocity small-ship phase began as waves of interceptors and light bombers from both fleets met and buzzed around each other like rival swarms of insects. The tiny lights whirled and danced in the void, faster and more numerous than the unaided eye could follow. Even the tactical displays overwhelmed the senses, pick plates flickering with thousands of type markers and flashing cursors, spinning, overlaying, vanishing and reappearing. The heretics had seeded a buffer zone behind their deployment with mines, and the Emperor's Hammer, spurring forward in a fleet intruder role, suffered heavy damage and was forced to break away. Heretic interceptors fell upon the stricken ship like carrion flies on a dying beast. The Will of Iron moved past the Emperor's Hammer and began to sweep a path through the mine zone with its specialized clearing devices. Triggered by probing force cones, the floating weapons began to detonate in their thousands. Spatian's intent was to cut a wedge into the enemy's wide formation and bring at least some of his ships within range of the planet's surface. Once that bridging objective was achieved, he could begin to unleash the planetary assault, confident of providing the dropships with some covering fire. The Saint Sithus was first to secure such a position. Its main guns mercilessly disposed of the heretic cruiser Scutum and forced the carrier frigate Glory of Algol into a desperate retreat. Hundreds of dropships rushed like a blizzard out of the battleship, and the two frigates, and the inquisitorial black ship that had moved in behind it. Most of the dropships were the grey landing boats of the Imperial Guard, jets firing as they hammered down into the cloudy atmosphere of 56 Izar. But scattered among them were a handful of scarab-black landing craft and drop pods of the Death Watch. The counter-invasion had begun. Within the first hour of the war, we managed to land more than two-thirds of our 120,000 Mayapua light elite infantry on the surface of 56 Izar, almost half of the motorized armor brigades, and all 60 Adeptus Astartes warriors of the Death Watch. Sensor sweeps showed 56 Izar to be a bland, unremarkable world beneath its heavy veil of atmosphere. Vast, low continents of inorganic ooze, punctured by ranges of crystalline upland and surrounded by inert chemical oceans. The only signs of advanced life, of life of any kind indeed, were a string of city-sized structures arranged in a chain along the equatorial region of the main continent. The nature and composition of these structures was virtually impossible to read from orbit. The heretics had concentrated their invasion efforts on the three largest structures, and Admiral Spatian was targeting these areas, judging that the enemy would not be wasting time invading unviable sites. Losses were high. The approaches were thick with enemy interceptors, micro-mines, and the fire of surface-to-air defences. All of this was human warfare. There was no sign or hint of any Saruthi participation at all. Behind the main landing force came the inquisitorial squads, five specialized assault units designed to follow the military in through the opening they made and oversee the primary objectives: the capture or destruction of the heretic conspirators, and the obliteration of any further Necrochuk material. I had control of one squad. The others were led by Endor, Shongard, Molitor, and Lord Inquisitor Rorkan himself. Voke was too ill to command the squad, and his emissary, Haldane, accompanied Endor's party. My own force, designated Purge II, was made up of 20 Gudrunite riflemen, Bequin, Midas, and a Death Watch space marine called Gilar. A member of the Adeptus Astartes had been seconded to each Inquisitor. Fischig had demanded to accompany me, but he was still weak from his injuries and surgery, and I had turned him down with a heavy heart. He remained on the battleship with Amos, who was, by any standards, a non-combatant. Our transport, an Imperial Guard dropship, left the St. Sithus directly behind the force designated Purge I in Lord Rorkan's lander. We rode out the vibrating, shuddering descent, strapped into the G-chairs of the troop bay. Yerus's men sang as we dropped. Their standard-issue Gudrunite uniforms had been augmented with fresh body armour from the fleet stores, and they had sewn inquisitorial emblems onto their sleeves next to the regimental badge of the 50th Gudrunite Rifles. They were in good humour, eager and determined, encouraged, I believe, by the faith I had shown in selecting them. Madathine had confided to me that they had scored consistently above average in the adverse training programme. They joked and boasted and rang out Imperial battle hymns like veterans. Their experiences since the founding at Dorsay had baptised them very quickly indeed. Bequin had also been transmuted by experience in the months since I had first met her on Hubris. A hard, serious woman had replaced the scatty, selfish pleasure girl from the Sun Dome, as if she had at last found a calling that suited her. She had certainly thrown herself into her new life with dedication and vigour. I considered the changes a distinct improvement. Many are called to the service of our beloved Emperor, and many are found wanting. Despite the ordeals, Elizabeth Bequin had proved herself. If there was a point at which her transformation could be identified, it was the plateau. The sight of Mandragore's corpse had exorcised her fears. Dressed in a black armoured body glove and a long black velvet coat, she sat in the seat next to me, scrupulously checking her las carbine. The chastener had trained her well. Her gloved hands made swift, professional movements over the weapon. Only the trim of black feathers around her coat's collar betrayed a vestige of the painted, frocked, and decorated girl of old. Midas sat the other side of me, ill at ease. He made a lousy passenger, and I knew he wanted to be up in the dropship's cockpit instead of the Navy pilot. He wore his cerise jacket, despite the objections of the Dur Gilar, who considered its brash colour unsuitable for combat. His needle pistols were holstered, and his long Glavian rifle rested across his knees. I wore brown leather body armour and my button-sleeve coat for the assault, a trade-off between protection and mobility. The symbols of my office were proudly displayed on my chest above my sash. Librarian Britnoth, in a gesture that honoured me, had sent a bolt pistol for my personal use. It was a compact, hand-crafted model with a casing of matte green steel. The rectangular pattern magazine slid into the hand grip, and I had one locked in place and another 8 in the loops of my belt. After 8 minutes of violent descent, we levelled out, and the vibrations diminished. Gilar, seated next to the ramp hatch, made the sign of the Aquila in the air and locked his helmet into place. 20 seconds, the pilot announced over the cabin vox. We soared down free of the clouds and into the fire and darkness of the near-surface war zone, moving at full burn towards one of the orbitally identified city structures. The site was ringed by a series of what seemed to be colossal lakes or reservoirs, and the liquid they contained was ablaze, with raging walls of fire reaching up thousands of meters. Night-black smoke fanned from the fires and blocked the immediate daylight, and the world below was amber-lit by the seething flames and the crossfire of weapons. The dropship shook as the braking jets fired, and we lurched around in a drunken yaw before settling. Gilar thumped a wall stud, and the ramp doors opened with a yowl of metal on metal. Cold air and smoke blew into the cabin. We came out onto a wide, glistening flat of white mud that squelched wetly under our running, jumping boots. The mud flats lay between two of the burning lakes, and we could feel the heat of the immense fires on our faces. The coiling flames reflected in dazzling patterns off the wet mud. Burning debris from a crashed lander littered the white flats, as well as the charred bodies of several Maiapois. Lasfire cut the air above us. A kilometer ahead, there were the familiar shapes of raised, hoop-like arches. Tetragates, as they had been dubbed by the fleet's tech priests, some shattered and broken by the assault. Beyond them rose the pearl-white flanks of a great edifice, the target structure, curved and segmented like a gigantic seashell, spotted with a thousand tiny scorch marks and blast scars. We advanced behind Gilar. The air smelled of fuel vapor and another rich scent, like licorice, that I couldn't readily identify. Purge 2, deploying on surface at chart Mark 7, I reported over the Vox.
Understood, Purge 2. Purge 1 and Purge 4 report safe landing and deployment.
So, Rorkon and Molitor's groups were down. No word yet of Endor or Shongard. As we pushed past the first of the shattered hoops, Gilar faltered, pausing to shake his helmeted head. I could feel the wrongness already, the insidious twisting of the Ceruthi environment. It seemed likely the effect was being accentuated by the broken tetragates. These silent devices projected and sustained the Ceruthi tetrascapes, and they were now faulty and incomplete. The Gudrunites noticed it too, but seemed unfazed.
Take point, I told Yarus, and Gilar looked at me sharply. You need time to get used to this, Brother Gilar. Don't argue.
Yarus and three Gudrunites moved into the vanguard. Even they were having trouble, shambling awkwardly as if intoxicated. The angles of space and time were truly bent and twisted here. Behind us, thrusters retched, and our dropship rose off the gleaming mud, its ramp and landing struts folding up into its belly. It was barely 60 meters up when a missile struck it amidships and blew out its mainframe. The burning cockpit section tumbled away from the airburst and fell into a lake of fire. Metal debris from the destroyed main section peppered the white mud below. But for the grace of the God Emperor, we could all have been aboard it. Moving at an unsteady trot, we came to the Ceruthi edifice. Its great luminous form was the size of an imperial hive, and its foundations ran down beneath the white mud. I tried to get a sense of the structure, but it was no good, and I quickly gave up rather than risk disorientation. It was like an ammonite with its polished segments and perfect curves, but my human eyes could not read its true shape. The overlaps and edges did not meet as one would expect, and conjured distracting optical illusions when any attempt was made to follow them from one point to another. We reached the foot of it. There were no doors or entrances, and those who had come before us had tried to blast their way through the lustrous surface, only to find it apparently solid within. I moved my squad back from the barrier, and we retraced our approach down the line of the tetragates. Those nearest to the structure were still intact. As I had anticipated, we stepped through the last one and were immediately inside the edifice, as if we had passed through the pearly walls. Inside, there was a low radiance shed by some source inside the walls. It was warm, and the smell of licorice was more pungent and intense. The floor, translucent and pearly, was concave and flowed up into the curve of the walls. We moved forward, weapons ready. The corridor, and I use that word in the loosest sense, seemed to describe a spiral, like the inner form of a great conch or the canals of a human ear, but at no time did we feel anything but upright. Opening into a horn-like cone, the spiral gave out into a huge, almost spherical chamber. It was impossible to estimate its true size or define its true shape. It seemed to be some kind of ornamental garden, or even farm. Silver walkways, suspended invisibly by gravity or some other force, ran between curving tanks of liquid that formed beds for huge, multicolored cycads and other bulbous, primitive plants. The fleshy growths towered around us, dripping with moisture and swathed in creepers and climbing succulents. Ropes of vine and beards of flowering foliage hung from invisible fixtures in the air above the beds.
There were insects in here, flitting between the swollen bell shapes, crescents, and columns of the gigantic vegetation. One landed on my sleeve, and I swatted it, noticing with revulsion that it had 5 legs, 3 wings, and no symmetry. We followed the silver path. It passed through a tetragate, and at once we found ourselves in another garden chamber, similarly filled with glossy, abundant plant life, thriving in sculptural tanks. The tallest growths in here, giant yellowish horsetails streaked with orange veins, rose 80 or 90 meters above the floating pathway. Gila called a word of alarm, and his storm bolter began to fire, raking across this second chamber from the silver path on which we walked. The shots burst gourd-like plants in fibrous bursts of sap and hacked shreds of leaf and tendril into the air. Return fire came at us, las fire and the crack of auto-rifles. Through the sickly growths of this indoor jungle, the soldiers of the heretics moved against us.